It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out how Wisconsin's drunk driving prevention efforts failed in a recent report.
First, we take a look at why Americans aren't reading beyond their borders. According to our next guest, only 3% of everything published in the United States each year is translated from another language, and the majority of that is computer manuals and other technical stuff.
And she says a nation that takes pride in its immigrant history and its multicultural sensibility, this aversion to translated literature is downright bizarre, and it's not at all serving American readers.
Our guest is Anna Clark. She's an independent journalist and a political media correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
So I want to start with that 3% figure. Only 3% published from another language in the United States? It seems kind of low. Can you put that into context for us?
It is an impossibly low number, and it becomes especially surprising when you realize that that accounts for all material published in the United States, including technical material, computer manuals, reprints of classics, things like that. The amount of contemporary fiction and poetry translating to English each year in America is astonishingly small.
So what is going on? Why aren't we getting more of the world's great literature that's being written today translated and sold?
There's a lot of reasons for it. I think the easiest thing that people might say when trying to talk about this is that there's a sense that American readers aren't interested in reading beyond their borders, but I think that's actually a pretty lazy understanding of what's happening. I think the truth is that a lot of major publishers have some difficulty in being agile enough and responsive enough to the best writers around the globe in terms of literary scouting, in terms of finding and vetting translators, in terms of actually bringing these books to market. And I think there's a lot of fear about being able to make the most of them through traditional publishing models. I think the best books, the best writers being translated in America today are actually being published by independent presses. And there's also a lot of really wonderful work being done by translators bringing those works into English. And they, too, have historically been a little bit rogue, you know, like translation has not been a historically valued art, even in academia. It's been something that actually sometimes counted against professors working towards tenure, to the point where many of them even, you know, like omitted the fact that they translated important works of literature from their, you know, CVs for fear that it would count against them.
Well, since apparently we are not reading literature that's been translated in America, tell us what we're missing.
Oh, we're missing so much. I mean, I personally, as a reader, I mean, I can't even begin to describe, like, how much I think that I've gained, you know, like, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually, even, by reading beyond our borders. I mean, obviously, there's an enormous number of tremendous American writers who, and other writers who work in English that I, you know, like, any reader would do well to spend time with, but you know, there's amazing people at work today. Elena Ferrante is one of my very favorites. She's one of Italy's most famous novelists. Her work is being published by Europa Editions, one of those like smaller independent presses that does fantastic work. And you know, she gets an enormous amount of critical acclaim. She's doing incredible things with her novels. And if more Americans are reading her, it's all the better for us.
So there are some big-name novelists out there, I gather, that we're just not aware of. Do you think that we're also sort of missing trends in the field of literature besides great books?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, first of all, I think that, you know, even if it was just for the sake of joy, it'd be worth it, you know, to bring these writers into English. But it's absolutely true that I think that our understanding of cultural affairs going on around the world, of major conversations happening in aesthetics, in politics, in, you know, all kinds of human relations, you know, like a lot of these are being vetted out through literature, you know, and I think that when American readers don't have access to those, it's a real challenge. I mean, a lot of those issues are, you know, very relevant to us today, you know, like those of us trying to figure out how to, like, grow towards a more equitable, integrated, multicultural, humane society. I mean, like, we can only benefit by, you know, paying attention to the most, artful and engaged writers around the world.
I'm curious about what it takes to get a book translated into English. You know, you look at something like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is a blockbuster. Does it have to be that big?
I think there's, major publishers today have a lot of concern about being able to have a profitable and sustainable model. And that's great. They should. I hope they do. You know, I want them to be able to continue bringing, important work into our bookstores and our libraries. But there is a lot that goes on. And it's true that, translations are trickier to do. I mean, it's not just a matter of, having a literary agent, sell a manuscript to a publisher, and with a little bit of editing, a little bit of revisions, a little bit of promotion, it's out there. There is more steps. You do have to get a translator. The publisher might have more difficulty communicating with the writer. Not just language wise, but through technology and so on. So there are a lot more steps, and that means I think that the publishers would like to see the cost benefit work out. So there is more of an interest in these writers who are costing a bit more to, bring more to the publishers. I mean, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, though, you're right, it was a huge blockbuster, and it's not a coincidence that a lot of these Nordic crime and thriller writers are having a bit of a heyday. If anybody's doing well getting translated into English right now, it's people in those genres, because publishers are hoping to repeat that.
So in terms of, what we can do, could consumers rattle the doors at independent publishers? What do we need to do if we want to see more of these books on bookshelves and bookstores?
I think the most important thing to do is to read, to buy, to talk about, to review, to engage with a lot of the really amazing work that is being published, because while it is a too small number, there is quite a lot out there. And I think if we engage with what is there, I think we can demonstrate the sort of market forces that major publishers will pay attention to. I think we just got to show that that American readers are interested, are engaged, we'll take the extra steps to find, voices that are beyond our borders. And so, the head of the Nobel Committee, who a few years ago accused American readers of being too insular, too isolated, and so on, we can show that that's not so, simply through our actions and by talking about it, just like we are now.
Let's talk about that. I mean, are we insulated? Are we not that interested in reading beyond our borders, as you put it? Is there something to that critique?
I think that saying yes or no is in both ways a little too general, because of course there are some people who I think would be put off, by things that by books that are not set in places they know, or who have authors who have a name that might be difficult for them to pronounce. But I think the truth is, most of us just care about a good, well-told story, and this is true in, all kinds of genres, you can have your popular fiction thriller types like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and you can also have much more, erudite sort of fiction and intellectual treatises at the other end. In the end, all of us just want a good book, And I think that there's a lot of ways, a lot of different kinds of readers can find ways to connect with this. And I think if most of us just give it a try, it will sell itself. It's not something that I think people should do out of a duty, but out of a sense of joy and out of a sense of interest and the incredible diversity of stories that really is out there, whether or not we know it.
Anna, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this today.
I'm really glad for the chance. Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Anna Clark, an independent journalist and a political media correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review. The group Mothers Against Drunk Driving, or MAD, gave Wisconsin 2 out of 5 stars in its recent campaign to eliminate drunk driving 2014 report to the nation. The only states that got a lower rating were Montana and Rhode Island.
The group is pushing legislation that would require everyone convicted of drunk driving to get an ignition lock, a device that won't allow your car to start unless you've blown into the tube with a legal blood alcohol level.
Here to talk about that legislation and other bills that could reduce drunk driving in Wisconsin is Frank Harris. He's the state legislative affairs manager for MAD. Frank, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, well, thank you.
So why did MAD give Wisconsin only 2 out of 5 stars? This is essentially a failing grade for the drunk driving prevention here in the state.
Well, MAD gave Wisconsin this rating because currently Wisconsin is not doing enough to stop drunk driving. Now, Wisconsin did receive a star for having a child endangerment law, which allows prosecutors to charge drunk drivers who drive drunk of a child passenger in a vehicle with an extra penalty. Wisconsin also received a star for having what's called an administrative license revocation law, which allows law enforcement to immediately seize somebody's license upon a suspected OWI arrest. Now, where Wisconsin is lacking would be really on the two critical areas that are proven to stop drunk driving and deter drunk driving, and that is the legalizing the option of sobriety checkpoints. Wisconsin's one of only 12 states that do not allow local law enforcement the option to conduct sobriety checkpoints, which are about as much of a constitutional inconvenience as a red light to a sober driver. The one push that we're really making for in Wisconsin is another star, which Wisconsin lacks, and that is the use of what's called an ignition interlock device for anybody convicted of drunk driving with an illegal blood alcohol level of 0.08 or greater. And currently there's legislation out in the Wisconsin State Assembly, Assembly Bill 738 by Representative Richards, that would require the use of interlocks for all convicted drunk drivers, and we also expect some other legislation to be introduced soon as well on this. And just the final area where Wisconsin could improve and where there is a legislative fix out there is the issue of refusals. Currently in Wisconsin, any first-time arrested drunk driver who is suspected of drunk driving, they can refuse a chemical test, typically, unless if they killed or injured somebody or they have a child passenger in their vehicle. And these offenders can refuse a test, and there is nothing law enforcement can do to compel somebody to give a blood or alcohol test.
Okay,
and
so
this is a result. Yep.
I was going to say, you've highlighted three areas there where Wisconsin, yeah, you feel needs to step it up from a legislative perspective. How does Wisconsin look compared to the rest of the nation on those topics you just pointed out?
Well, again, currently there's 20 states that require interlocks for all convicted drunk drivers, including Illinois. There's 38 states that legalize the option of sobriety checkpoints. And there's over 30 states that allow for no refusal activities. So, and these are three simple legislative measures, or at least two of them are pretty simple legislative measures that lawmakers can take to better stop drunk driving in an effective way to stop drunk driving.
Now, against some of the arguments against what you've been talking about in terms of the ignition interlock, there are critics who say that they aren't always that effective, that there are ways to get around them. And, you know, so why put something into place when you're not sure that it's going to do the job? And as you talked about, there are constitutional questions about the checkpoints. And I wonder what you would say to those arguments.
Well, what we say regarding ignition interlocks is, well, it's not a silver bullet, but it is one of the most effective countermeasures out there for convicted drunk drivers. And just like with any penalty, there's ways to get around it. But an interlock, if it is installed on a convicted drunk driver's vehicle, is proven to reduce that offender's likelihood to reoffend by 67%, according to studies by CDC. And that's why it's important to have a comprehensive bill that makes sure that once an offender's on an interlock, that they're on the device, and they only can earn their way off with the last couple months of violation freeze. And an interlock, it also currently Wisconsin utilizes ignition interlocks for all refusals, repeat offenses, and first offenses with a 0.15 blood alcohol level. And currently, interlocked offenders in Wisconsin have to submit every 30 days, they have to bring their device in to get service. So if there's a violation, that information is available. But MAD believes that overall there should be, you know, legislative action taken to improve the current ignition interlock law.
How would we improve it if you had your way?
Well, we had our way. You know, again, we support Representative Richards' Assembly Bill 738, and we understand there's been a proposal that's been kicked around to the Department of Transportation as well that would make it more of an option for a first-time offender to go on an interlock at a 0.08 blood alcohol level, and make it an option in the sense that an offender could immediately go on an interlock upon arrest if they wanted to, drive wherever they want to as well, just safe and sober. And then that would just be, instead of having a temporary license after an OWI arrest. You would just have an interlock restricted license. And states like Nebraska are utilizing this approach, and they have seen compliance with their interlock law increase significantly. And this way, this might maybe gain the alcohol industry's sign of at least not opposing it, because it would be more optional. But we'll have to see. And this might be something that we're just running a little low on time for this year to push out.
But. Now, as we get ready to listen to some news and get updated there, I do want to ask you one question. What about the penalties on the books in Wisconsin? Do you think they're enough to deter drunk drivers?
Well, again, drunk driving is a crime, period. And the majority of people who cause drunk driving crashes in Wisconsin have no prior convictions on their record. So, a first offense, that could equate to someone killing somebody. So drunk driving should be treated as a crime. Now, the legislative will to do that is probably very, well, just seeing what happened this year, it's a tough mountain to climb. So one compromise would be putting that offender on an ignition interlock instead for 6 months, which essentially has the same penalties as a misdemeanor, as it costs about $400 to $500 to that offender to use that device.
And I'm going to jump in. We'll hit pause on the conversation, come back in just a bit. We're talking to Frank Harris of MAD about why the group rated Wisconsin so poorly in its efforts to prevent drunk driving.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think Wisconsin should do to prevent drunk driving? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
We're continuing our discussion with Frank Harris of Mothers Against Drunk Driving about why the group rated Wisconsin so poorly for drunk driving prevention.
We're taking your calls now as well. What do you think Wisconsin should do to prevent drunk driving? What do you think about sobriety checkpoints or ignition interlocks? Why do you think Wisconsin has such high rates of drunk driving? You can call in and let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org.
And we're going to go right to the phones and take a call from Kevin joining us from Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello, what do you think?
Mike, well, I would be in favor of sobriety checkpoints, but more importantly, why can't the ignition interlocks be made standard equipment on all U.S.-sold vehicles like seatbelts have come to be?
Okay, Kevin, thank you so much for your call. And Frank, what do you say to that?
Well, again, MAD supports interlocks for those convicted of drunk driving, and but as part of our campaign to eliminate drunk driving launched in 2006, one aspect of our campaign calls for the support of advanced technology that will one day, unobtrusively and seamlessly and passively detect if a driver is at a 0.08 level or not before their car starts. And if somebody's at a 0.08 level, their car won't start. And right now, MAD is cheerleaders on this project between the auto manufacturers and NHTSA. It's called the DADS program. That's currently just started a 6-year of an agreement here. And this technology, it's not too far off where it will be an option on new vehicles for people to purchase. That if you're at a 0.08, your car won't start. And essentially, this could decriminalize drunk driving. This could put an end to drunk driving, and decriminalize it because drunk driving will be a non-factor.
So people can police themselves in that case.
Well, essentially, they can, and people can find out more information on this at dadss.org. Essentially, this will turn cars into the cure and one day eliminate drunk driving, which, costs about $128 billion a year to citizens in the United States. And, this is called the DADS Project, and there's a lot of support for this bill on Capitol Hill from the alcohol industry onto traffic safety groups like MAD. So, this has a very real option to one day eliminate drunk driving, hopefully in my lifetime.
There was a statistic that MAD has used to show the need for drunken driving prevention, and it estimates that a first-time person convicted of OWI has driven drunk at least 80 times prior to being arrested. So that's 80 times driving drunk before they get stopped. That's an incredible number. Can you talk about how you came up with that?
Well, that number is from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And, you know, we've talked with researchers because we used to say 87 times, but that stat was a bit outdated. So this stat is based off of data from the CDC, which, you know, glad to forward along. But, you know, on average, it takes an offender 80 times before they're actually caught to be arrested and go through the process. But that's just kind of points to the importance that, again, you know, there needs to be proper deterrence of drunk driving, and the way to do that is to have high-visibility law enforcement activities like saturation patrols, which Wisconsin does, and sobriety checkpoints to deter people from driving drunk in the first place.
Let's go back to the phones now. We've got some folks waiting to talk to you. First, we have Larry from Winter. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Yes, my comment is regarding the checkpoints. I've experienced it twice over in Minnesota, and it isn't a minor detour from your day. It takes anywhere up to 20 minutes to go through these things, depending on how crowded they are. But my main objection is the fact that it's illegal to do this. It's a case where you have to actually prove that you're innocent of a crime.
Larry, I
have nowhere else.
Go ahead. Larry, are you there? Nope, I guess we lost him. Well, I'm curious if you, Frank, could tell me about the sobriety checkpoints. I haven't been through one, as Larry has. Is he right? It takes 20 minutes. Could you talk about what happens at a sobriety checkpoint?
Well, it depends on the sobriety checkpoint that you go through. But typically cars, they're picked out systematically. So law enforcement will pick out every fifth car, every sixth car. And these are typically set up in an approved fashion where they're legal in the states, and they'll just ask the drinker if they've been drinking, and if there's noticeable alcohol on their breath, then they can go through the process of a sobriety test. But it's done in a systematic way, so that at a sobriety checkpoint, you just don't go after somebody like, you know, a car full of kids, for example. That would be against the rules of a sobriety checkpoint. And the goal of a sobriety checkpoint is, again, a deterrence, so that sobriety checkpoints, I believe, should be well publicized, that so that people can find other ways to get home after a night of drinking. And just be noted that Matt has no issue with people 21 and older consuming alcohol. It's just the best game plan is always to plan ahead.
What about Larry's point that it doesn't seem constitutional to him?
Well, according to Michigan v. Seitz from 1990, ruled by the Supreme Court, ruled that sobriety checkpoints are constitutional. And currently 38 states do allow for sobriety checkpoints. Now, Minnesota actually doesn't allow for sobriety checkpoints anymore. And that's but in Wisconsin's actually one of three states where all it would take is legislative action to legalize sobriety checkpoints again. And those other nine states where checkpoints are illegal would take legislative action and a statewide referendum.
Let's get in one.
So they are legal.
All right, let's get in one more caller. Ben joining us from Riley. Hi, Ben.
Hi. I was calling to say, you know, I think what we're dealing with here is more of a cultural problem than something that more laws is going to fix, because making something more illegal doesn't generally do anything if you've got an enforcement problem. And I think that's what we've got. I live next door to a tavern, and I've tried to call in, you know, obvious cases of drunk driving, and I've been told by dispatchers to mind my own business. It's not something that's going to be as simple as, you know, stop everybody on the road or stop every fifth person on the road. I agree with the last caller. That's no matter what a court says, I think that's a clear violation of people's constitutional rights for the same reason he said. But
I'm just going to jump in.
Why can't we address this at the point that it's a problem?
All right, so you're talking about an enforcement problem. And so, Frank, could you talk about that in our last minute here? Do we have an enforcement problem? And how optimistic are you that Wisconsin will move up in MADS rankings?
Well, hopefully, you know, I think it's going to be tough to pass checkpoints, obviously, in a state like Wisconsin. But Wisconsin law enforcement, they are teaming up with the local all different agencies and local counties through task forces to do high visibility saturation patrols, and that's what law enforcement should do to enforce the current laws on the books. But when the current laws on the books are so confusing and so antiquated, there needs to be an update so that they're made more effective, so that offenders are having the proper repercussions for violating the public's trust and driving drunk. And Matt believes one way to do that is to make sure that anybody who wants to drive legally after an OWI can only do so with going on an interlock for at least 6 months. I mean, this has a benefit to the offender in teaching sober driving behavior and a benefit to the public by ensuring that that offender is driving sober.
Well, Frank, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was Frank Harris, State Legislative Affairs Manager for Mothers Against Drunk Driving. He was with us to talk about what Wisconsin can do to better prevent drunk driving.
It's time to learn something new. Each week during Teach Me What You Know, the Teach Me What You Know segment, we invite an expert to join us to teach us something new. Last week, we learned how to sort through the walls of wine at a liquor store and pick out something good, but not too expensive.
This week, we're learning how to respond to medical emergencies. You never know what kind of situation you might need to be prepared for. And the president of Wisconsin's EMS Association joins us now to share some advice on what you can do.
Joshua Kwalke, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
What is the first thing that we should do when we see someone that needs medical attention?
First thing and most important thing is to make sure 911's been called. So you want to either call 911 yourself or instruct somebody to call 911.
What information is important to communicate when we get on the line with 911?
The really important thing is to, first of all, tell them where you are, because they need to know where to send emergency services to. And the next most important thing is to let them know what's going on. So if somebody's having a medical emergency or if there's a fire or police are needed, just really telling them what the situation is.
Mm-hmm. As an emergency medical responder, what are the most common calls that you respond to?
As far as the ambulance, EMS, we respond, I would say the most common would be falls in the home, when people fall down and basically need assistance.
Hmm. Say we are a first responder ourselves, how should we help someone when they fall down?
The first thing you want to do is see what their orientation is. So are they still talking to you, and do they remember everything that happened? It becomes really concerning when they have an injury, for example, a hip fracture, so they're having some hip pain, or if they've hit their head and they don't know, remember what happened. Those kinds of things are really concerning, so it's important to call an ambulance if that's the case. If they don't have any real injuries, they're, no head injury, no back or neck pain, certainly you can help them up and get them back into a chair.
Mm-hmm. What are some signs that maybe we should or should not move them or get them in a more comfortable position?
If they have head pain, neck pain, back pain, all of those things become very concerning to us as emergency responders. So we want to make sure that those people just stay in the position that they're in until we get there and do our assessments. So you don't want to move them or help them up, even though it might seem like the right thing to do.
Talk about preventative measures just a bit. What kinds of things can we do in the home to prevent falls?
Like I said, falls in the home are the most common thing that we respond to, and a lot of times the falls are because somebody has an extension cord or the rugs that we all like to have in our homes that are pretty and decorative, but they're in the middle of the floor and people trip over them. So those things, you really need to be careful about where you place them and making sure they're secured to the floor so that they don't become a trip hazard.
So let's say a friend or loved one has fallen down and hit their head. How do I know whether or not they're suffering from a concussion?
If they have confusion, they're repeating questions, just not acting right, maybe they had a loss of consciousness, so they didn't respond to you for a few seconds to a couple minutes, all of those things would indicate to us that there's a more severe problem and you probably need emergency medical services.
And there are several situations we might respond to where someone's life might be in danger, another one involving choking. What should we do when we encounter someone who's been choking after, of course, we've called 911?
For choking, we want to do the Heimlich maneuver. So to do the Heimlich maneuver properly, what you're going to do is you're going to place your fist just above the belly button on the person's abdomen. You're going to stand behind them and just wrap your arms right around them. And like I said, put your fist just above their belly button. Put your other hand over top of it, and you're going to squeeze inward and upward as hard as you can because you want to push the belly up against the diaphragm and the lungs to try to push that object out of their airway. So you need to do it really hard and really fast until they either go unconscious or they start breathing.
I imagine that that is difficult to do, especially if you lack a certain amount of upper body strength. Do you have any advice for doing the most effective Heimlich maneuver possible?
The best thing, like I said, if you need to go inward and upward, so you might have to have them get down on their knees or something. If you're shorter than they are, or if you're doing it on a child, you might have to get down to their level. But that's really going to be the best thing, is just getting those inward and upward thrusts as hard as you can.
Is it possible to pull too hard or to, you know, create injury in some way?
No, you need to do it. Otherwise, they're going to die from not having oxygen. So it needs to get done hard and fast.
Talk a little bit about the physiology, I guess, of that. Why does it work?
Like I said, the diaphragm pushes against the lungs. And basically, you're squeezing the abdomen, which pushes against the diaphragm. So it's squeezing, even when you breathe all the way out, your lungs still have some air in them. So it pushes that air against the object and pushes it up out of the airway.
What should we do if the victim does go unconscious?
At that point, you need to lower them to the floor as gently as possible. So you, when you're doing this, you also want to make sure that you have a good grip on them. And lower them down to the floor, onto their back, and then you just start chest compressions. You can look in the airway to see if you see anything, and if you do see something, pull it out. But otherwise, you just start doing chest compressions right in the middle of their chest on their sternum. You're pushing down about 2 inches as hard as you can and trying to push, again, the air out of the lungs and push that object out.
So talk a little bit about why those specifications, two inches up or 2 inches down as you're pressing in the middle of the sternum. What's happening there?
Again, you're pressing on the lungs. That's also the same maneuver that you're going to do for CPR. So if somebody's heart has stopped, you're going to do that exact same thing. So this is kind of covering both bases. If somebody who isn't able to breathe because their airway is obstructed, their heart is in danger too because that's not getting oxygen. So this is kind of covering both bases in that we're trying to still get that object out, but we're also doing chest compressions to help circulate blood in case the heart stops.
There's some discussion over whether or not you should actually give breaths as well as cardio compressions. Should we be trying to do rescue breathing, and where does the confusion lie in that issue?
There's different standards out there. Certainly, if you're not comfortable doing rescue breathing, the studies have found that it's very ineffective with people that don't do it on a regular basis. So if you're not comfortable with it, chest compressions are totally acceptable until the first responders, EMTs, or paramedics get there, and then they can start doing their rescue breathing with a bag valve mask. But you know, certainly you can, if you're not comfortable or not able to do rescue breathing, you can just do chest compressions.
Now, would this be the same process that we would use for a victim who's experiencing cardiac arrest, for example?
It would be, yep. You're right in the middle of the sternum again, right in the middle of the chest. They say the nipple line, so, you know, right in the center of the chest, and you're just pushing down and trying to do 100 compressions a minute, so they're actually pretty fast.
Mm. Whether, I guess, another emergency that people may experience is a stroke. How can we recognize a stroke when it happens?
A stroke, normally the person has slurred speech. They may be confused, not know what's going on. And a lot of times one side or the other side, either left or right side of their body, isn't working. So they'd have paralysis on one side or the other side of their body. And when that happens, it's really, really important to call 911 immediately, because a lot of times those people can be helped if they get to the hospital in a very quick or very short amount of time. So it becomes really important to make sure that 911's been called, and then write down what time the symptoms actually started, because that becomes important later on with treatment.
And in this very cold winter, we've also heard of some cases where, hypothermia is an issue. How should we respond to that?
Important things with hypothermia is just getting the person into a warm area if you can, getting any wet clothing off, because wet clothing will make you get colder faster. As far as rewarming an area that may have frostbite, you don't want to use real hot water, so very, very, very lukewarm water, and just warm the area up slowly.
What about if I'm out ice fishing in the middle of a lake and I don't have quick access to a warm environment or even warm water? What options do I have?
Again, if your clothing is wet, getting that off and getting blankets or other people's coats perhaps or things like that. It just becomes really important to get somebody to a warmer environment and starting the rewarming process.
You know, in these scenarios, I guess in a way it's easy to talk about it in the hypothetical, but in the moment, as we're faced with a situation, it can incite maybe a lot of panic and nervousness. What advice do you have for keeping cool in an emergency?
The best thing to do is remember to breathe. Looking around, making sure you're seeing everything around you, because it's really easy to get that tunnel vision, and just make sure you're breathing. And if you need to, count a little bit to make sure that your breaths are going in and out, and just keep looking around and just try to remain calm and think calm thoughts.
Any other advice for how to save a life?
Like I said before, the very most important thing is to always make sure 911's been called.
That's great advice. Thank you so much, Joshua, for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Joshua Kowalki, president of Wisconsin EMS Association. He's joined us for this week's segment of Teach Me What You Know to talk us through how we can handle emergency situations. This week, going through instances like choking, home falls, CPR, and the Heimlich maneuver.
And maybe you have an idea for a segment to teach you what we know or what one of our guests knows. We are always looking for ideas. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page. You could also send your ideas to talk@wpr.org.